Welcome, everybody, to Juwanza for Life. My name is Juwanza. Thank you so much for tuning in, everybody. I don't take it for granted that you couldn't be doing something else, but you heard who my special guest was going to be today, and you decided to spend time with us, and I'm so thankful. If you've been following Juwanza for Life for just even the last month or so, you know that I've had the opportunity to speak with a very, very special guest, a very powerful guest, a very educated guest. And the last two shows that we did together were called Ethnicity and Nation Building in Francophone Africa. We did a part one and a part two. The information was so much and so broad, we couldn't even contain it in one show. It was called Ethnicity and Nation Building in Francophone Africa. If you missed those shows, they're archived, so you can go back and listen to them, part one and part two. You will get a thorough education concerning the topic. And my special guest for those shows is back today. My special guest today is Professor Gilbert Doho. He's Associate Professor of French and Francophone Studies and Founding Director of the Ethnic Studies Program at Western Reserve University, Department of Language and Literature in Cleveland, Ohio. And again, if you missed those shows, you really have to go back and listen to them again, because they're packed with powerful and just informative information that you really need if you're interested in such topics. Today, we've got a show that is really, really out of this world. I mean, this is one of those shows that if you're into African history, African studies, then this show is going to have you riveted. And we're going to be talking about kingship and kinship within the Tikar people of Cameroon. So my special guest is back again. Dr. Doho, thank you so much for agreeing. As always, it's an honor, sir, to have an opportunity to speak with you. I really appreciate you being my guest again today.
Thank you for having me. And thank a lot for those who would be who have been listening to us since we've been discussing about Africa and what Africa can bring to the world, should bring to the world.
Absolutely. It's truly, it's been riveting to me. I mean, I've gone back and I've listened to the shows again. I've shared the shows with other people. And as I mentioned, anybody that's interested in Africa and the history of Africa and, you know, the having the opportunity for us to delve into certain aspects of what we've been speaking of is just, it's food, you know. So I'm truly enjoying it, and I'm just happy to be able to share you with my listeners as well. Today we're going to be talking about kingship and kinship within the Tikar people of Cameroon. Now, just for starters, if we can, again, I like to, you know, throw out definitions so that people, when they're listening to us, they know when we use a word exactly how we're using it, because some words, you know, words denote meaning, you know, and so how a word might be traditionally used and how we're using it may be different, or vice versa. So when we say, or you say, king, what exactly do you mean when you say king? Because, you know, we, especially a lot of people in the diaspora, grow up with a Western mindset, and, you know, when we think of a king, we think of one thing, but that might not be what you're speaking of when you say king. So when you say king, what exactly do you mean? Who is a king?
Yeah, when I use the word king, I use it to deconstruct, to destroy the colonial meaning, the colonial denomination, the colonial restructuring of the existing people organizations or structure in what you call Africa today. Okay, the colonial restructure everything, what existed. For instance, kingdoms that existed thousands of years before that had fought other kingdoms, formed empires and so on, deconstructed again to come, you know, either small or large size of kingdoms. Europe consider that as kingdoms, or the imperialist force could not consider, and by that I mean Germany, France, and, you know, all those who invaded Africa for slavery first, and later on, you know, for colonization. They couldn't call those social structure, those structuralization kings. That would be putting them in the same, at the same level of what existed in Europe before.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm simply saying is, in the vast continents of Africa, you had kings that had achieved or accomplished achievement of more value, higher level than was Louis the 14th, Louis the 15th, or the English kings and so on. But the English, the French, and by this I'm referring, I'm coming back to my area, the French could not just accept that you had such strong organization. Let me just say it for you to really understand. When I talked of the Tikal and I accept that word, it's a position of vast ethnic groups that were structured in larger and small kingdoms. The colonizer, the German, the English, and the French restructured their kingdoms and called them chiefs only.
Called them chiefs?
Okay.
Did you say chiefs? Okay.
A chief, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a chief, just to say that we are dealing with people with no value who are not really organized, or who were organized, but their organization were of no value. We cannot consider that. We cannot put them at the level of our kingdoms.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
okay.
One of the many kingdoms that I'm referring to, the Bamun people. Now, the French people would never tell you that you are talking of a kingdom, a dynasty that goes as far back as 13th century. The traceable king of the Bamun people dates back to 13th century. Today, the present king of the Bamun people, the 19th king of the Bamun people, or the Sultan, Ibrahim Bombo Njoya, he's a part of that vast kingdoms organization that the French people simply named them chief of first degree, second degree, and third degree, depending on the the number of the population each kingdom has.
Okay.
So what we're talking, when we talk of kingdoms, we are talking of real organized people with a king at the top, but kings follow, because you have common people within the kingdom. The stars vary. But,
well, what would be, if I may ask, what would be the equivalent of a sub-king? Then you mentioned sub kings. So if traditionally in the traditional Tikar arrangement, or, you know, for lack of a better term, structure, what would be an equivalent of a sub king, so that when you use the term sub king, someone here could have an idea of what would be the equivalent?
Right. The equivalent, again, we're referring to let's say a quarter, or what you might call a division, for instance, of a city, okay? You have the mayor, okay. And the city may be divided by a number of people who are the heads of those divisions of the city, okay? The king,
mm-hmm.
who is the paramount king, has a territory, and that territory is occupied by people structure from what I call seven major heads or seven major quarters. Each quarter sometimes has at its head a sub-king. Now, let me be clear. A sub-king may be so given by the paramount king. But a sub-king may be a noble family, a prince, or even a king that asked for political asylum in that kingdom. Because that king is related, has some kind of blood with the paramount king, he cannot just throw away his relative. No, he would give a section of his kingdom and say, go and establish there and be the quarter. So these sub-kings do not, as I say, are not part of the council directing the kingdom. No. The king has his nine notable with whom he directs the kingdom. But he also relies on sub-kings to see that the kingdom works the right way.
So do the nine notables that counsel the king, for lack of a better term, do the nine notables that counsel the king, would they be considered higher in rank, for lack of a better term, than the sub kings?
Absolutely not. No. No. They are part of what you might call the council of the king, of the reigning king. Their function lasts as long as the reign of the king, you know. Once he is dead, their function finished. The would-be or next king would select his own nine notable. They would then continue the management of the kingdom. He would probably acknowledge the existence of the sub-king that were before his coming into existence. But he might, because of balance of power, anoint other successful noble in the kingdom and give them what I call symbolic sub-kings, because real sub-kings reign on sections of the people within the kingdom. But, you know, the king always tried to balance the powers, tried to seek, you know, those with whom he governed the large or small population, and almost always he has to rely on people on whom he can count. That's why the reigning king, who has a lot of wives and a lot of children, almost always plays his girls to his own people, to his own chiefs, sub-chiefs, notables, and also place them outside of his kingdom. By that, I mean give them in marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Why does he do that? Because it is in the belief of the large Tikal people that you cannot cross the blood of your people, the blood of your brother. That's the curse that is very, very difficult to uplift. And that's why a king, having a number of children, mostly girls, send them to marriage within the kingdom and outside the kingdom in order to have them there as a kind of, what would I say, something that makes him sure of himself. Because if I am son-in-law of the king, I can never take arms and go against the king. I can never complot against the king. So a king try as much as possible to develop what, and here we know that we are entering on the second term, which is kinship, blood, relationship is very, very important within the Bamun, Bamileke, the large Tita kingdom in general.
So before we get into the blood, I want to ask this question before we move into that section of the discussion. You just mentioned the Bamileke and the Bamun, and these are under the, I want to use the word heading, of the Tikar. These are groups within the Tikar. Now, and the Bamun, in my understanding, and please correct me if necessary, my understanding is that there may be a Bamun king, a Bamileke king. Now, but because they fall within the Tikar group, is there a Tikar king over, say, the Bamun king and the Bamileke king and any other groups within that fall under the Tikar or fall within the Tikar ethnic group?
Excellent question. Let's deconstruct the concept Bamileke. When you take somebody, a subject of a kingdom of the last ethnic group called the Bamileke, they don't always refer to themselves as Bamileke, because this term was chosen by the German to name part of that vast people's structure from the Adamawa to Bamenda and so on. They call them the, you know, the Bamileke, and sometimes the grass field. Mm-hmm. So what I'm simply saying, the grass field or the Bamileke people are constituted of a number of kingdoms. Today, they are not less than 101 kingdoms of the Bamileke. The size varies from 200 to, let's say, 50,000 people on the limited ground that the Bamileke people have.
Mm-hmm.
But because of demography, most of them almost always emigrate to other places, but they never, never forget that they are from that particular kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Within the Bamileke, I am Ngumba, Funda, which is part of six kingdoms formed by six brothers. Okay? We speak one specific language. Six. But when you move around us, you have another group that would form all these people that the colonial administration, in order to manage them quickly, name them the Bamileke people. But of course, among them, they have Tika, they're related to the Tika people. Among them, you have Asai, one other group, which exceptionally, and I say the history of Bamun people is exceptional within these, the grass field in general, because the Bamun people, they've been able to trace the succession, their dynasty, to the 13, you know, first or the creator of their kingdom, to the present. Whereas some can go as far as 9, because the culture morally there is oral. And part of the initiation of a king is to teach you orally that you know your those who took the kingdom or managed the kingdom before you. It's a, how will I say, intellectual teaching where you have to learn and retain. This is always done during the initiation of the would-be king. Now, is there a paramount higher king of the Bamileke? No. There are various kings of the Bamileke, 110, depending on size. They are all primus inter pares. That is, they may be different in size, but they are equal. They are brothers.
Okay.
It's not because you are 200 that you can wake up one day and invade me and so on. You can do that, but other kings will remind you that's not how it is. I am talking of people, of kingdom that have been turning before, you know, during the years of slavery and later on during colonization. Hello?
Everybody must guess it's Professor Gilbert Doho. We're having a great conversation about kingship and kinship within the Tikar people of Cameroon. If you're listening by phone or listening online and you'd like to join the conversation, if you're listening by phone, all you have to do is just press 1 and I can bring you in to the discussion. If you're listening online, the call-in number is 515-605-9297. Again, if you have a question or you'd like to make a comment and you're listening by phone, all you have to do is just press 1. Professor, I hope I didn't cut you off.
No, it's okay. It's okay.
Okay.
So this is very, very interesting.
I think one of the most interesting parts which you just shared was that the kingdoms range in size, and that somebody that is the king over, a community of 200, you know, is no less powerful than somebody who has say 50,000. I mean, that is serious respect, for lack of a better term.
Let me put this put that forward for you to understand better. Sometimes during their reign, kings establish good relationship with other kings. And then, as I say, they may send their daughters to that king. And almost always, whoever would take the king the kingship should always remember that within that kingdom is or was a daughter of a king of less number of population. So he can never go or deconsider that king. It's very, very important. So you see, establishing blood relationship between these kings, and it's not only kings, the kings themselves, the paramount kings, it's also families, lay families which are not part of nobility to the nobility in general. There are always interchange of members of families, marriages along the line of kingdoms. That's why at one time you can move from your own kingdom and go to another kingdom and establish yourself easily, because there you have elements of your blood. It's very, very important. And that's why when the German attempted to fuse all of them into one, no, they couldn't break the identity of the Bamileke people. No, each kingdom continue. And the French came and pushed it forward to the point where they did not only, how will I say, change the denomination of kings and say chief, etc., restructure them, change away those who did not accept the colonial power, but because of the acknowledgement of that which has been there for a long time, it was really, really difficult to break. This kingdom continued to go on today. Whether we're talking of the Tikka, whether we're talking of the Bamun, or whether we're talking of the Bamileke, they are kingdoms that existed before the German colonization, during the German colonization, and the new nation that was part came out in the 1960s.
So you ask me, how then is a king chosen? Okay, do you think we're going to be moving into the kinship part? Because once you have a king that's established, then is that kingship passed down from father to son to father to son to father to son? And or what role does morality play in any of this? Because, you know, if let's say you take someone who might be the heir apparent, but they just have not established any moral, it doesn't appear that they just have learned any lessons that would equip them to govern effectively. So what, well, first, is it passed down father to son, father to son, father to son? And then what role does morality play in the choosing of the successor?
Right. Now, this is a very, very good question. But let me tell you, a king can never be the center of imperfection, negativity. No, a king is always the symbol of excellence, of merit, the best that exists, because he is representation of God on earth, according to the Bamileke Tikka people. A king. Kings that come in not to hold excellence in morality, that king would always be gotten rid of one way or the other. So whether we're talking of, and this is, it's not because the succession from father to son that you can just take a mediocre and then you put in power. The succession is a long-term observation by the king, the reigning king, but also by the nine notable that form the council. And then, of course, the reigning, the cabinet, what you might call the cabinet, and of course, the seven sub-kings of the kingdom. They observe the children of the king and they see which one is really, really from the moral, from the bravery, in fact, from what I might call positive values of the Bamileke Tikka people. You see it in that child. It is that one who would become king when the reigning is dead. But, sorry, did I say the reigning is dead? No, you never said Bamileke Tikka or Bamun king is dead. The king is never dead. If you say that, you've destroyed the kingdom. No.
Okay.
Even when the king is dead, they said he has traveled. He is sleeping. Etc. And during that period, they would look. They would be meetings where the kingmakers, the nine notable and friends all over would come and say, okay, this is the child that the reigning king chose to be. You can never necessarily be the next king if you say, okay, I claim because I'm the eldest son of the king, I'm the next king. No, that's not the way it is shown. The king will select his own, ask questions from his friend, try to tempt him, see if in him there is justice, there is bravery, there is fairness, or there is hard work, there is protection, bravery, or what you might call what made of a king a king. If he satisfied all that, the reigning king would go to a number of people and say, this is my successor. But the sign that he would give to four, five people about his successor are not the same signs. But those signs will indicate the man, the child that the king has chosen.
And so what if you have a situation, Professor, where there may be three or four, and I'll just use the word candidates, not that they are vying for the position, but you just have three or four young men that exhibit the traits of honesty, bravery, truthfulness, you know, all the moral characteristics, leadership, all of the moral characteristics, the kingly characteristics, four or five of them. And at some point, let's say that four or five is narrowed down to two. Okay, it's four or five narrowed down to two. Do they consult the priests in the kingdom to say, you know, consult the oracles to, you know, get an answer? When it comes down to that, how is it chosen when it gets to that point? If it gets to that point,
there we go with some writings that have mystify the children of a king in the oracle and so on and so forth. Yes, there may be oracle, but what I'm telling you is a concrete selection of a leader of the people. And the oracle cannot be the only voice that can be heard within a palace. Because the palace is a basket of crabs. And each child in the palace wants to be the next king. Queen wants her son to be the next king. So it's a fierce battle. But the reigning king counts on the wisdom of not only the nine with whom he has been reigning, you know, managing the nation, on the wisdoms of the seven who are part of his kingdom, but not necessarily part of the decision-making, on the wisdoms of other kings to make a final selection of who is the next kingdom. Now, I am talking of a real, authentic, that it was, you know, I know all that was perverted by the colonial administrator who chose sometimes who the colonial administrator won, depending on the obedience of that king to succeed to the deceased king. Okay, they even today the central government of Cameroon sometimes put his nose on the selection of the next king, but almost always council of the notable, the advice from a kingdom's near is very, very important, and almost always a decision is taken. Now, let me tell you this. Sometimes a palace can stay vacant for many years until they lay hand on who is the right king to be there. You see what I mean? Because of the quarrel and so on and so forth. So the king, part of his own wisdom, is to try and select the best of his king, of his children. That one who marries, that one who carries value. But he has to be tried. He has to overcome obstacles before becoming a king. Oh, yes, that's what initiation is all about. It's not because you've been selected to become a king that you ipso facto become a king.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get my point?
Absolutely. I'd like for you to talk
even
about that. Could you? Because that's very, very important.
Even the first,
because on the surface, you can appear to
yeah.
be.
Even okay. Let me.
Yeah.
This.
Go ahead.
Even the first choice of the reigning king sometimes fails to be, you know, to successfully go through all the obstacles or all the trial that he has to have during the 9 months of initiation. Once a king is dead, then you never say the king is dead. Message circulate among the nine and all those who, the notability that, oh, the king of, let's say, the king of Ngum, of Bamun or Bam, Bafunda or, has traveled. Or the Baoba has fallen, or the elephant tusk does not exist anymore. These are metaphoric sentences to tell you the king is dead. Once you hear that and you have a proof and the deceased king has given you a hint of his successor, as a nine, you go to the palace, meeting of a meeting. During that period, the palace, everybody just go alone, not saying anything. Once they know who is, they would convene, say that the king is summoning people to a meeting. And during that gathering where they expect that the reigning king would address his people, the notable would come out, the nine, those who have, now, no, not that, a secret society would come out and then, you know, go among the people and walk casually. And then when they see they near the chosen one, they would grab him, hold him, and start beating him in the, you know, in the public, or they can beat a slave, and the slave would start crying. It may be a good that when they grasp the would-be king, they hold him, they tell him 4 or 5, he can not run away. They can beat the good, and the good would cry. At that moment, you hear somebody say, long live the king is dead. At that moment, every day, on the marketplace of the palace, or on the, how will I say, on the public ground or square of the palace, the queens and the sons, they would be crying, mourning their father, who is dead. But we know that the king is dead, right? The king has just been arrested, that, right? A would-be king is there. They will take him to a secret and sacred bush, which is near the palace. Secret bush. They would initiate him. What does it mean to initiate him? That took me years to go and learn what it means. It means simply make him feel good, feed him, rot him with palm wood, you know, and then teach him the history of his people. You know, your father was this, he had that friend, this, etc. In fact, enlighten him about the past of his people, about his friends and his enemies, so that when he decides to choose his own line, he knows who is chosen. So in the secret and sacred is joy. But at the moment that they arrested him, a few beautiful girls, etc., and they went into the initiation with him. Part of the trial, part of what he should be successful in doing is to impregnate one of the girls during the time he would be in the initiation in Latcam. They call it Latcam. So as I said, it's always 9 months. So you can imagine what may happen, you know, conception.
Well, he can impregnate more than one in 9 months.
Well, what is important is because of the the problem for me is, but why did you people take? I asked one of the notable, why did you people take him to the initiation ground and you have to wait for 9 months? He looked at me and laughed. He said, "But you have to understand, we want him to prove that he is not barren. A king can never be barren because he is the symbol of life. He is life himself. He is the giver of life, the protector of life. If he cannot give a birth to a child, therefore he's not qualified to be a king." So during the 9 months.
So you would never have a situation where, as like, for example, with the Dalai Lama, you know, they chose this child, you know, this young boy. I mean, he was like, he looked like he was probably like 5 or 6 years old, and said he was the next Dalai Lama, you know. And so he was groomed and grew up, you know, being told that you're the next, you know, you're the Dalai Lama. I mean, surrounded by whatever, you know, comes trappings that come along with that. But that would never take place then in such a society as the Tikar, because you can't be a boy, a baby, and reproduce. So that couldn't happen. So is there an age limit on the age of the king?
That is what you call the regent sometimes. That is what they call the regent sometimes. Or the regent, which is, if you are a young, they can put you, you know, have somebody, you know, follow you until you become a man, and then the regent will just see the place for you to take your place. But whatever the case, there would be a moment when you would prove that you can procreate. There is no possibility of a Bamileke king, a Tikar king, or a Bamun king. There is no possibility for you to access to power if you cannot procreate. Procreation is part of it, because life is procreation. You have to be able to produce life. And by that, I don't simply producing human beings. I'm also producing, you know what I mean, the wealth of the people. Make sure that
you. So would you be able to have already had children prior to being chosen then? Because let's say, for example, you already had a child, already a parent or a father, time you were chosen, or could that ever be? If they saw a young man and he, could he have already passed that aspect of the initiation, because maybe 20 years old or something and already have a child? Could that be possible? Is that a possibility?
Excellent. That's almost the easiest way of, how will I say, anointing the next king, right? If he has already, he's already had a compound, because they can seize you when you have already a compound, children, etc., etc. But still, you are going to go through the initiation. You are going to prove that during your initiation, you have a child.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean? They cannot simply declare you king like that. You have to prove to the people that you can create. I thought you were going to ask question this way. What if a king is unable to procreate? I thought that was the question.
That was next.
You were asking.
Right.
Can the king who is barren, can he, despite all that, become? The answer is no. I asked, a king, it can never be barren. Men are never barren within this society that we are talking about, because you have this provision during the time of initiation, you have beautiful, strong men who are there to guard the initiation. They may be part of secret. What do you think they do with the young women who are in the secret and sacred forest? Now, in a family where you need, you are chosen to succeed to your father, can you be barren? No. You have to bear a child. If you are unable to do, who does that for you? Members
well,
of
let
your
me
family.
Ask you this. Let me ask you. So what about
brothers,
then? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I mean, so we are dealing with a society where, according to the way they structure, they make it that men or barrenness is not men, male, but female. Because almost always, you cannot shame a man who has built a compound and married a woman. If that man has a brother, an uncle, etc., they will help him do what achieve what he is unable to do. Does that make
well,
sense?
Is it possible for a woman to occupy the throne?
Sorry?
Is it possible for a woman to occupy the throne? Impossible?
Well, now we are leading. We are now it's moving. Now we've almost reached the place of the women, far as becoming a king is concerned. Can a woman become a king? Within is there any kingdom within these societies? Is there any possibilities for a woman to become? There are rare moments when women have raised up to be strong and taking the direction of some kingdom. I mean, they talked of the mother of Jamdunke, who was the mother of the 17th king of Bamun, who assured the regency until the son become, she was then the power that be within the Bamun people. Yeah, there's a possibility, mm-hmm. but almost always, women are, how will I say, a major cornerstone as far as, making the king is concerned. Because without giving birth, or without showing that you can procreate, you can never. Now, what is the statue of the woman with whom the king has the child and is coming out in public and say, I have to be enthroned? She is not only the queen, but she is a queen who has power because she was also initiated. She was also mm-hmm. given some powers when she was in that initiation ground, etc. She was also conditioned, prepared that she has not only normal but mystical power. Like the king is conditioned to believe that he's a panther, he's a lion, he's a buffalo, etc., etc. These are some of the symbols of power that you see on the throne of the king, on his cane, etc., etc. During his reign, he is made to believe that he has that capacity of transforming himself into these mighty animals that are symbols of power within the Bamileke, the grass field, the Bamileke, the Bamun, and the Kika in general. So women are very, very powerful. She's a powerful woman, and others become the queen. Always, her house is always the first on the right hand side as you enter the palace, which is always built on the slope of a mountain. Okay. Of a slope of a little mountain, okay, and as you go, she is how will I say? She has power. She is there, not only to send the regulate the palace, etc., but also can tell the king, okay, you know, this palace, you are there, I'm also there. So women have power. In addition to that queen who successfully enabled the king to be a king, there is, of course, the queen mother. The queen mother, that is the mother of the king. She is, how will I say, inherited like all the other women by the king, by the new king. They are in the palace. The king makes sure that he builds their own houses, but far away from his house, which is in at the bottom of the slope, because the king cannot go to bed with his mother. That doesn't make sense. So all the queen, those women, the queens that are the age of the queen mother, they are far away on top of the palace, but not on the right hand side, but on the left hand side.
So what happens when the king travels? What happens when the king travels, or shall we say, goes to sleep? If you know what I mean, you know, because we don't say that the king is dead. So what happens when the king travels or goes to sleep? What happens to his wives, the queen mothers, or you know, his queens? Who is whose responsibility do they become to look after them and to care for them? Do they become the successor's responsibility?
Yeah, that's what I've just been saying. The king who goes in Lakham, and he is initiated in Lakham for 9 months, he comes out with all those women that were in the initiation secret and sacred forest with him. Their houses are built in the palace, which is made of a row of houses on the slope of a mountain, okay, or little mountain. Not the way, I use the word mountain is even, you know, too. So what happened with his mother, with all the queens that he was calling mothers? He can also inherit those women, but he makes sure that their houses are built far away from his own wife, as I saw it from the configuration of my own father, is always on the left-hand side of the new palace constructed. It may be the old palace, okay, but there is no king that sometimes just easily go to. A king may decide to go and create a new palace somewhere and leave the old palace, etc. But he always, there is always reconstructing the palace to really make sure that the wives of the deceased king, that is the queen mother, and they are co-wives or co-queens, they are in the palace. It is his responsibility. They are his wife. Same thing with his brothers. Mm-hmm. Once he is the king, according to the value of the Tika, the Bamileka, once they become his children, whether we are talking of somebody who is older than him, he becomes his son.
Mm-hmm.
He referred to them as my children, and the respect of Ara is there. Nobody questions that. Yeah.
But does the king have a title? I mean, a name that denotes him as king? I mean, you know, a special name or a special title or something given to that person as a name that when people hear this name, they know immediately that, okay, this is the king, or this is part of the king's family, this is part of the king's, this is one of the king's wives, this is one of the king's sons, even if that son is not a king, because they are the son of the king. Then is there a name that's given to them that is recognizable so that everyone, when they hear it, they know?
Right, okay. When you, in terms of once you become a king, they name you after the name that your father gets you, King Jovenza, okay? One way of really making you know, because it's very important, they relate you to your mother, okay? They say, but which Jovenza are you talking about? Okay, you say the Jovenza of this woman, and then the name of your mother.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because, again, we are talking of blood. There is only one person who is sure of your blood, that you are that real blood. So by referring to you, they really know that who you are. You are not somebody from the bush. Now, are there other names? Okay, the king, you don't call him by the name that he was having as a child before, or as a young man before becoming a king. You don't call him, no, you just add His Majesty Jovenza, His Majesty that, okay, His Highness that, etc., okay? But of course you had other honorific titles that the sons and the daughters of the king, they do have as they come, as they born. For instance, the first daughter, if the king who comes out of that camp gives birth to a daughter, they call him Ntukam. Ntuk means the drinking cup, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The drinking cup of the king. You understand what I mean? That's
yes,
a specific name of the child, of a girl that is born by the would-be king who is being initiated. They give him Ntukam, which is, how will I say, the honorable, how will I say, drinking cup. If
mm-hmm.
it's a boy, they call him Pokam. Pok means mushroom. A mushroom is special, okay? It's special, okay? As the king, you know, as those children, men and women of the king, as they develop themselves within the kingdom, they are married, give birth to the children, they can acquire titles which have nothing to do with the title of their father. Okay, the father may give, or the king may give them a title depending on their success. We are dealing with a society whereby you don't simply, enjoy, the privileges of nobility without achieving something yourself, without showing that you are a capable person, that you can raise and build not only yourself, but the kingdom that you desire, you crave, you want to manage. So even within the children of the king, there is the demand, the insistence that each child must show the best of himself. And there are names that goes with the success of prince and princesses. And the king really acknowledged that. Now, remember, I said the king, the palace is a basket of tribes. When a child shows that he is very, very successful, the king and then the nine notable and many other regulating forces within the kingdom always make sure that they are far away from the king. Far away means in a quarter that is not near the kingdom, because you never know what may happen. Oh yeah, you never know what may happen. A child,
no, Professor,
a,
this. Yes, sir.
So we.
So you never know what may happen.
Yeah, you never know what may happen. Yeah, I mean, a king, a prince, may be so successful, so thirsty of power, that he can decide to get rid of the father and take over the power. Has it happened in the past? Yes. How do you take care of all that?
Mm.
Now, tempting as there may be, some bad behaviors within the kingdom, which goes from theft to, how will I say, to, let's say, committing crime, which is the crime of, let's say, you may kill somebody inadvertently, or I do not know. I mean, you kill deliberately. What happened to you? How do you solve all those problems? So we've cut elements or the making of a king, but we've not go deep into some of the mechanism that makes sure that a king can never abuse of his power. A king should never abuse of his power within this kingdom. If he does, what do they do? What are the mechanisms that are in place to make him that, you are a bad king and we don't want you anymore? Question.
Professor, that we're going to have to do
that
a part two.
Probably.
You want to do a part two?
That will be probably the part two. What I'm simply saying,
I want to give everybody one last chance in this show. If you have a comment or a question for Professor Doho, this is my special guest today, Professor Doho of Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. Awesome, awesome information. If you're listening by phone and you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, just press 1. If you're online, the call-in number is 556-0597. Awesome, awesome show, Professor. I am so very grateful to have you on as a special guest. To all my listeners, if you're really enjoying this information as well, and you're loving what you're hearing and you're loving what you're learning about traditional African kingships, there's another interview that's in the archives that I did with Dr. Owahehi Medira and Comet. He's paramount king of the Washington, D.C. region of the Osara Society, and he's written an awesome book titled Divine Kingship of Asante, A Model for Sustainable Development of Self and Community. An awesome, awesome book. And he really delves into the Asante model, because as you know, as you can probably tell, Africa is very, very big, very, very large. And from community to community, from group to group, from country to country, from kingdom to kingdom, there may be variances in the way they do certain things. So Dr. Owa, he talks about the Asante model, and you can actually get the book on Amazon. If you go to Amazon and you just type in the Divine Kingship of Asante, then that should come up. And his name is spelled H-E-H-I-M, like Mary, E-T-U, Ra, that's R-A, in Comet, E-N-K-A-M-I-T. Another PhD. I've been very blessed to speak to some very, very intelligent, awesome, awesome guests. So, again, that's the Divine Kingship of Asante, A Model for Sustainable Development of Self and Community. You definitely want to get that book as well. Professor Doho, I'm blown away by the information that you've shared. You really have delved into and really, really shined a light on the kingship and kinship of the Tikar people. By the way, you notice, everybody, you've noticed if you're looking at it, the title, if you're looking at how it was printed with a K. Cameroon was spelled with a K. Professor, could you explain why that is such, why is that the case? Why a K and not a C? A lot of people see Cameroon spelled with a C. Why a K?
I choose, and I continue to choose it today in most of my papers provocatively, because and I hope some of you will tune to my talk that is coming on the 18th, ethnicity. I will talk more about all that. When you look at Africa today and our past, coexistive past with slave mongers and imperialistic force, we can never throw away that past. That's my first view of things. You can never remove away the fact that you are, contrary to me, you are, or your ancestors may have been, my uncle and so who came here to this country through the demeaning process of slavery, nor can I deny the fact that we were colonized, and the colonized are viewed as slave on their own line. So we should accept elements that came. And I choose Cameroon because the German coex these organized society from the highly structure Bamileke, Bamuntika kingdom of the of the grass field to the northern Lamido, etc. To the south. I mean, we were coexed into an entity which is German Cameroon. And of course, we know that one of the direct consequences of this First and the Second World War was the division of Cameroon into two. And French Cameroon for 4/5 and British Cameroon for 1/5. Since then, we've been struggling with identity. It's either Cameroons, Southern Cameroons, Francophone. I mean, why go to what divide us more, bring us together, than what bring us together, which is the colonial past of Cameroon, which is the name that we have, which is Cameroon with K. But why do we even choose that name, Cameroon? Can we go deeper and choose another name that best fit us? I do not know. I'm just trying to use that to provoke people to think. It's something like, the Ghana of today was called the Gold Coast. But the Ghanaian probably thought that it would be better to search into their past and have another name. Upper Volta became Burkina Faso, and Dahomey, the territory of Dahomey, which became the Republic of Dahomey, they search into their past and then they choose Benin. What I'm simply saying is Africa is only 50 to 60 years old in terms of nation building and so on. And we have to go deep into our past and be genuine and not only question the form of state today that divides us more than bringing us together. We have to, rethink of the values that we had in the past, and that both the slavery and the colonization or colonialism name that or consider that negative. Maybe the grandeur of Africa comes from what was denigrated yesterday. I think we have to be convinced ourselves instead of rushing after new, whereas we have, gold near. Let's fight our fight, which is what we are, search what we are. Why do you want me to throw away my clan, if that's what I still continue to believe, my ethnic group, when if it's what the others still see me like that, I take it. And then I say, yes, I'm proud to be the subject of His Majesty within, a republic. I am a subject citizen. That's what makes my identity, my ethnic group clan, my tribe clan. I didn't say tribalism. That is an exclusive love of my people to the exclusion of the others. No, I've talked to you of many kingdoms with different people organized, but who lived together by exchange, blood, etc., that exists. Why can't we assume, take what was fling on our face and turn it positive?
Professor, I'm over here. I am over here smiling broadly because I am thoroughly enjoying what you're saying, and I know that we're going to have to do a part two, a part three. Maybe we'll just do a series. We'll just do a series, you know, because this information is great. It's powerful. It's educational. And for those of you who are listening, if you're enjoying this, then you, if you're listening online, you can just follow the show, and then you'll be notified. Every time I do a show, you'll be notified of the guest, the date, the time, and the topic. Today's show was titled Kingship and Kinship. Okay, Kingship and Kinship within the Tikar people of Cameroon. And if you missed it, you need to go back and check out the last two shows I did with Professor, Ethnicity and Nation Building in Francophone Africa. We did a part one and a part two to that one as well. Professor, I truly appreciate your time, my brother. Thank you for being my guest today and sharing all the powerful information that you shared with us today. You've given us some extended time, and I thank you for that. I really appreciate your time, and I look forward to having you back on as a guest again.
The pleasure was mine. Thank you.
Thank you. Peace and blessings. Everybody, that is Professor Gilbert. He's a professor at Case Western University in Cleveland, Ohio, Case Western Reserve, and awesome information concerning kingship and kinship within the Tikar people of Cameroon. And again, we'll have to have him back, and if you're one of those people that enjoy this and you say, I got to make sure I hear that, then you need to follow the show. Again, I need to tell you again about the book that I referenced earlier by Dr. Orwahehi Medera and Comet. It's called, the book is called Divine Kingship of Asante, a Model for Sustainable Development of Self and Community. This is an awesome, awesome read. If you're interested and the type of information that you just heard today with Professor Doho, and you'd like to learn about the kingship, the divine kingship from an Asante model of that kingship, then you need to get this book. Okay, and you can get it by going to Amazon. All you have to do is just go to Amazon and type in, I'll give you the title again, slowly, Divine Kingship of Asante, and Asante is spelled A-S-A-N-T-E, a model for sustainable development of self and community, and that's by Dr. Hehi Medera Nkamit. And I'll spell his name for you. It's H-E-H-I-M, like Mary, E-T-U, space, Ra, R-A, space, E-N-K-A-M-I-T. You have to get this book, and you can get it at Amazon. So everybody, I want to make sure that you know that Professor Doho is going to be a regular on the show. He's got a lot of information about, you know, concerning Africa that he's going to be sharing with us. And again, I encourage you to, you know, tell your friends, tell other people that you know that, you know, Juwan's for Life is back. We took a little break, but we're back. And so, again, I want to thank you so much for your time. You could be doing anything, but you've taken time out of your day to spend it with my person and Professor Doho. So, again, spread the word. My name is Juwanza. Who am I? I'm the one who, in giving, receives more. Who are you? Peace.
the battle. Had a sweet as a victory for the heat. Jaja put the heathen back on the wall. Had the heathen back. Don't Jaja put the heathen back.
Big